Broadcasting from deep in the Eublepharis galaxy, on a small planet called Gekonia, east of the Albino Hills and south of the raging Leucistic River, comes the one, the only, Gecko Nation Radio.
Good evening, everybody. It's great to be back, and tonight is going to be an epic edition of Gecko Nation Radio. Today is February 16, 2014, and we have our friend and sponsor, John Scarborough of Gecko Boa Reptiles, joining us tonight. I admire John's work very much. He has some terrific things to bring to the gecko community, and I feel he's just getting started. Tonight's going to be a special conversation because we're going to discuss the subspecies of leopard geckos, the ones that occur naturally in the wild. And these very special geckos are coveted worldwide by breeders and collectors for their purity, and basically they're untouched by the hand of man genetic quality about them. One can certainly appreciate all the incredible morphs that we have today, and also consequently the natural beauty of these animals is also just quite impressive, in my opinion. So it's going to be one of those episodes that, you know, if you're seeing a lot of people talk about Eublepharis fuscus and macularis and efasciolatus and stuff like that, hardwickies, you're probably wondering, you know, what's so special about these geckos? They kind of look like our leopard geckos, but then they're kind of different looking as well. We're going to figure out and help you guys learn all about these wild types tonight. And so I'm looking forward to that. I have to tell you guys, I'm kind of like on the end of a nice bout of pneumonia here, and I believe I picked it up sometime after the last expo in New York last week. So I'm actually feeling better tonight, which is great. I was kind of under the weather the last couple of days, but all bouncing back and getting back in the groove of things. I want to thank everybody for making Gecko Nation group on Facebook just a huge success. Everybody in there is posting, having a great time. It's really taken off quite well. And we just started doing, we started our first auction in there, and it's going to end tonight at 11, I believe. So if you guys want to get in on it, it's for 1,000 Dubia roaches from AB Dragons. And this was a trial run, so if it goes well, we'll do more auctions in the future. That'll be group specific. There'll be, you know, exclusive auctions just for Gecko Nation group. So if you like the group, if you like what's going on in there, get some others involved. You know, the group will grow. We're at like 1,300 members now. In addition, I'd like to thank our sponsors. Gecko Nation Radio would not be possible without our amazing sponsors. And these plugs that I do for our sponsors are sincere. These are businesses that I stand behind 100%. And we'll stake my reputation on theirs. Check this out.
Gecko Nation Radio is a David's Fine Geckos creation and production. You can visit the show's Facebook page at Gecko Nation Radio. I also have a great family-friendly group on Facebook called Gecko Nation. Apply for membership today. Gecko Nation Radio is sponsored by
Rainbow Mealworms is the largest worm grower in the world and selling to the public since 1956. If you need the highest quality mealworms, superworms, and crickets for your pets, contact them at www.rainbowmealworms.net.
Gecko Boa Reptiles is your source for the highest quality leopard gecko morphs and wild types, from white and yellows to radars, amazing tremper morphs, and rare subspecies. John is a world-class breeder and extremely knowledgeable. If you're looking for something truly special in geckos, contact John Scarborough at geckoboa.com and on Facebook. ABDragons.com is your source for the highest quality Dubia roaches, whether you're starting a colony of your own or just need feeders for your insect-eating herps. ABDragons.com can't be beat in quality or price. They are also a huge distributor of FlexWatt reptile heat tape and have very competitive pricing. Check out ABDragons.com online and on Facebook. Dale's Bearded Dragons is your one-stop source for any reptile supply products that you may need, from Exoterra, Zoomed, Rapashi, Repcal, Fluker, and much, much more. and all at 20 to 50% cheaper than your local pet store or big chain pet store. They are also the biggest reptile supply distributor at most of the Northeast Expos. Contact them directly online at dalesbeardeddragons.com or message me on Facebook and I'll put you in touch with the owner. And if you're looking for quality food for your dubia roaches, crickets, mealworms, and superworms, look no further than MS2 Premium Insect Chow. Made with reptiles in mind, it contains no dog food, cat food, or chicken mash. Using only vegetable proteins and high-quality ingredients, MS2 Premium Insect Chow will have your feeders making a beeline for it. Contact ms2ent.weebly.com or it can also be purchased at Rainbow Mealworms and AB Dragons.
And that's not all, everybody. We just added a few more sponsors, and I have basically capped off our sponsors for the time being. We may rotate sponsors in the future. If some, you know, take a break and not sponsor the show, I'm able to bring new ones in. So sponsors come and go sometimes. We'll see how it goes. Some sponsors will stick for the long haul. We'll see. But I hope to be able to have opportunities available in the future for more. I just don't want to overcrowd our listening, our airtime with all commercials. But the show would not be possible without these sponsors. So that's important. Dad from Ohio Gecko, amazing gecko breeder. He's on board as a sponsor now. If you guys are looking for cool fat tails, some really unique projects, definitely check out ohiogecko.com. Wally from Supreme Gecko specializes in crested, a bunch of different micro geckos, and does a lot of great promotional stuff and just a bunch of giving back to the community. And I like what Wally does. His website is supremegecko.com. And finally, and our newest sponsor, which I'm really just very excited about, is Reptiles Express. Reptiles Express is the best shipping company for shipping animals. And not only are they pretty much got the best rates, but they definitely have the best customer service. And that is a huge kudos to Debbie Price over at Reptiles Express. She helped me get started with shipping. And it's not always something that you're comfortable doing if you've never done it before. But once you learn how to do it, it's so easy. And Reptiles Express makes sure that your packages are tracked all the time. So definitely check out reptilesexpress.com. Excellent shipping company. Special announcements is basically next weekend at the Hamburg Reptile Expo. I hope to see you guys there. I'll be there with Blake, and we'll have geckos, snakes, and, of course, Flexlot Reptile Heat Tape, the real genuine stuff. So come see us at the show. And if you guys are getting involved with geckos or you're listening to the show, you're probably looking to, you know, get a lot of information, and you're trying to find other people that are involved in this great community. Here's a great place for you to go find some more friends. Check it out.
Did you know that since 2006, there's been a treasure trove of history and information on leopard geckos and other species? Well, Gecko Forums is the most extensive database of leopard gecko history on the web right now. Take a look and delve into the past, present, and future of this great community. The biggest contributors, breeders, and hobbyists have left their mark there. Now it's your turn. Look, learn, and post away. Need a place to post animals for sale? Look no further. Visit geckoforums.net and become a member today. Gecko Nation Radio is proud to be the official radio show associated with Gecko Forums.
That is right. We are proud. It's a great forum. All right. We're not going to waste any more time, and we are going to go ahead and bring on our esteemed guest. And John Scarborough runs Gecko Boa Reptiles, amazing breeder, and just doing some incredible work with Eublepharis species. In particular, but he also works with some other interesting animals too. We'll talk a little bit about that tonight. So, Mr. Scarborough, welcome to Gecko Nation Radio.
Great, thanks for having me on, Dave. Appreciate it.
Oh, of course, no, absolutely. Thanks for coming on. I'm looking forward to tonight's show and getting some good information out about wild types. And you pretty much have all of them right now, don't you?
Yeah, I have all that are currently recognized. I know there are other species out there that haven't been identified yet, but as far as whatever's known to the hobby, I have everything now.
That's awesome.
I got.
Yeah, I'm really impressed.
Oh, go ahead.
Right, you know, I was going to say, I'm really impressed with the most recent ones that you got, which are the Fuscus.
Yeah, that was kind of a dream come true. I've been looking at those for years and years and years, and it was kind of finally getting the unattainable, you know, this last ham show. So I was really excited about that.
That's cool. Yeah, and it's not so easy to get these geckos, and you know, if they finally made it here to the States, and I think they're in very good hands. So I'm glad you're able to basically pioneer these special subspecies for us, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to happen in the future. Before we get started with your interview, we're going to go ahead and bring on Sure. He's got some important information for us tonight, because I've been seeing some links going around. So let's go ahead and do this.
Good evening, Gekkonians.
There he is. What's up, Steve?
How's it going?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm a little under the weather as well.
I can hear it in your voice.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately.
Right. Do you have any good news for us tonight?
There's a couple of good stories.
Okay, cool.
We'll start out, excuse me, researchers have found that certain species of crocodiles can climb trees as far as 4 meters into the air.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it turns out that at least 4 species of crocodilians can climb trees. Also, smaller crocodiles are better climbers than larger crocs.
Hmm. Interesting. Do they say if they're doing that to catch food or just for the fun of it?
it didn't say, and it didn't list which species either. That Yeah.
Okay.
So that sends us to our next story. In the UK, a town councillor in Bristol believes that he has captured the first video footage of the infamous crocodile that is thought to be, thought by some to reside in the river, in River of Avon. The alleged 6-foot-long reptile was previously spotted in Bristol by a bus driver. We heard that story last week where it was spotted. But to be honest with you, the pictures he has, it just looks like a log in the water.
Okay. Maybe somebody's smoking angel dust over there or something.
Yeah, who knows? But that's a councillor. So I don't know, a town councillor. So...
Right.
Hopefully he's not counseling too many people.
Okay.
And then we're going to head to Paris, where officials at a Paris aquarium announced the arrival of 2 young albino alligators, about a year and a half old, and are 2 of only about 50 living albino alligators in the world. So the aquarium just got 2 new additions. Albino alligators.
Interesting. Those are cool.
Yeah. Which that leads us to our next story. In New York, a 23-foot-long, 300-pound albino Burmese python arrived at the Staten Island Zoo. Named Fantasia, will be on permanent loan from the Brooklyn Children's Museum, where he had been loved by children since 1998. And Fantasia is expected to live at the zoo for the rest of her life.
That's
and it's
cool.
being dubbed New York City's largest snake.
All right. Well, that's some positive news about Burmese pythons, at least.
Yep.
Very cool. All right.
And our next story is always cool to hear. A new species of day gecko has been discovered in Madagascar. It is a natural occurring albino, and scientists believe It adapted this way because of the flowers that inhabit its surroundings are mostly yellow. So a new species of gecko.
Wow.
Yeah. And our best story of the night and our last, sea turtles released in the Keys. A male and female loggerhead sea turtle rehabilitated at the Florida Keys Turtle Hospital have been released back into the wild off the island chain. So that's awesome.
Okay.
So that's our news. There wasn't a whole lot this week. There was another story about a reptilian. I'm trying to remember. It was some kind of official in the UK. I can't remember. I believe his name was Key, and he is being suggested as a reptile along with Justin Bieber. So,
okay. All right. Well, anyways,
the recap. There was a lot of articles were about that official, and I just didn't do that story. So. But, the recap is certain species of crocodiles can climb trees.
Mm-hmm.
The infamous Bristol crocodile. Rare albino alligators come to Paris. New York City's largest snake. New species of day gecko. Sea turtles released in the Keys. That's our recap. One of those stories are fake.
Okay, and I'm not gonna enter my judgment in this because I already know which one's fake in this story. So I'll let John go, and then I'm gonna put it to all of you guys in the group. What is your guess on the fake story, everybody? Go ahead, John. What do you think?
I was thinking that the albino day geckos was fake. Is that it?
Well, hold on. Let's see what Let me see what the other people are saying. The tree crocodiles, crocs climbing trees. Sean's going with the new species of day gecko, the natural albino. Let's see. Who else? What everybody else is saying? Yeah, Jeff says the monkey crocs. I can see how they would both seem kind of believably to be false. So, all right. So pretty much it's either the day gecko or the crocodiles climbing trees. So, what do we got, Steve? Which one is it?
John was right. The day gecko is false.
The naturally occurring albino. Well, I tried to tell people. See, that was actually my idea for a false story, everybody. And it's pretty funny. I don't know what I was thinking that I'd be able to fool John with that, but I guess it was worth a shot.
Yeah, albinos
I think John would have lost some credibility out there if he fell for that one. So I'm glad you didn't, John. That's cool. All right. Well, of course, part of our news that we do is the herp history, and I love this segment.
And now, a moment in herp history.
All right, on March 16, 1961, a 22-foot python escaped its cage at the Henley Zoo in Florida and fatally crushed a veteran snake handler, Alfred Henley. The 210-pound snake was later found in a tree. So this is one of the stories so far that I've found of a large python, and it didn't specify the species, but this is 1961 so far is the oldest story I found of a snake crushing a person to death.
So wait, could you elaborate on it? So the snake actually constricted and killed the person, or what happened here?
Yeah, it said that the snake escaped and then and killed the owner and handler of the zoo, Alfred Henley. But the snake was not there when the body was found. So it's kind of a little questionable, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I think big snakes have been used for a long time to just basically make people go away. And
yeah.
It kind of seems like it to me. Like, who's going to question it, especially back in 1960?
Yeah.
Wow, interesting. And that should be like a cold case file that should be reopened or something.
Yeah, the body was found next to the cage with the snake missing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just said that he was crushed. But who knows, you know, what kind of autopsies were being done back then, you know?
Yeah. Somebody got away with murder, I think. Wow.
Yeah.
So what's going on in your collection, Steve?
I'm trying to be patient. The hardest part of the season right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just waiting.
Waiting,
and then
exactly.
The next hardest part is waiting for the eggs to hatch. So.
Yep. Wow. So you got some cool stuff cooking, though, right?
Yeah, I should, you know, not anything over the top or anything, but to me they are.
Oh, they're all cool.
They all are, so.
Hell yeah. That's awesome. All right, well.
I'd be happy hatching out in a normal. You know, so.
Yeah. And we also, Steve, we also have the I guess it's the end of the public commenting on the CatX coming up this week, too, right?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
And it's been extended quite a bit, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Herp Alliance got us the first extension, and then I think, I don't know if it was US Arc that got the next one, but... Yeah, I think it ends officially the 22nd, I believe.
21st, yep.
21st,
deadline.
Okay.
21st, yeah. All
right.
Yeah.
All right, well, everybody that's listening, if you haven't posted your public comment about categorical exclusions, it's all over Facebook Reptile pages pretty much, and you can find it on the Herp Alliance, usherp.org, and usarc.org website. So please make your public comment on that. It's important. All right, Steve, if there's nothing else, I'll let you go. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with? And give us your contact info.
You can check us out at BC Barker Creations on Facebook and YouTube.
Awesome. All right, thanks for another edition, and get well. All right, Steve?
You too.
Thanks, bud. I'll see you next week.
I'll see you then.
All right. And everybody out in the listening land and in the chat room, you can pretty much count on the fact that John is going to be making all kinds of noise during the interview because he just likes to do that because he's busy working while the shows go on, and he's famous for that. So, John, keep clinking and clanking.
I'll try to
get away with that. That's all good. All right. Well, this is an important show. Right now, in the world of leopard geckos especially, there's a huge buzz about wild types, subspecies. It kind of plays off of the whole thing where a lot of us breeders are trying to either strengthen our lines, test breed our lines, and of course the purists that like the natural forms of leopard geckos. What do you find so appealing about the wild types, and what is it specifically that interests you, John, enough where you've made substantial investment into acquiring these amazing additions?
Well, I've always been interested in kind of the way things are naturally, you know, in nature. We get these geckos in, and, you know, we interbreed them, and, you know, they end up being something totally different than what is actually found in nature. And it's kind of interesting to see when, you know, to do the studies and see the areas where, you know, different localities will actually display a different visual appearance depending on where you are. So, you know, and it's one of those things where most of the leopard gecko species look similar, and maybe not everybody knows the difference, but, you know, the genetics behind them are kind of showing them to be more of a cryptic species where they actually are different species and different, you know, completely unrelated to other groups. So, I mean, I just find it fascinating to see all these different types. And, you know, when you get into some of the actual species and not dealing with macular subspecies, you start getting into very different animals. Like, you know, to most people, an Agrimani would look, you know, similar to a leopard gecko, but when you see them in person, it's totally different. You know, much bigger species, different attitude, different, you know, altogether. So it's just really cool to me to see how all these things are naturally. And for me to have them, you know, every one of them in one room, you know, I display everything from Turkey all the way to Eastern India in one room. You know, for me, that's just really cool. And I've always been into the localities and stuff like that. Even when I still work with some boas, but, you know, even with boas, I was really into the localities and the different species of boa constrictors. And I've always been interested in that kind of stuff. You know, the morphs are fun, and all the breeding for different genetics is fun, but, you know, there's something I really enjoy about working with the actual wild types.
Oh, I can appreciate it, absolutely. So how many subspecies are known right now, for people that don't know, how many subspecies are there? What are they called?
Well, you got to be, when you're saying subspecies, this is a common misconception. You're talking about subspecies of macularis. So you'd be talking about Eublephis macularis fasciolatus, and Eublephis macularis montanus, or Macularis macularis, and even Macularis afghanicus, even though I think they're a separate species, or they should be classified that eventually. Those are subspecies, and they're subspecies of macularis. Now, when you talk about Eublephis angermanu, that's a different species altogether. It's not not a subspecies, so you wouldn't say that's a subspecies. And there very well could be, you know, once we're able to go in there and have scientists really study this stuff, there very well be, might well be actual subspecies of even Agrimonu, just the same as there is macularis. Or there might be subspecies of Fuscus, or subspecies of Hardwicki. You know, that could be, you know, these different things. And we're already seeing, especially, you know, in India and in Iran, there's a lot of different variations of these animals. And, you know, the phylogenetics or the testing for the genetics on these animals is showing that they're very different genetically. You know, even though they can look very similar, they are very different genetically. So.
And speaking of the Angrimanias in particular, you have two different locales that have significant visual differences about them, right?
Yeah, there's currently with Angrimania, there's the most common is Kazakhstan, then there's Kermanshah province, and then there is Ilam province, and there's a couple others, but those are the main three that are common in the pet trade, or even not common, but you know you're much more likely to see one of those than anything else.
Right.
And I keep Kermanshah, and I also keep. I keep two different lines of Kermanshah, and then I also keep Elam. So, but I have everything that I keep. I have unrelated animals, which is good. I'm starting off with, you know, unrelated genetics as I go forward. So, pretty much every species that I keep, I have unrelated genetics, and then even in the subspecies, I have unrelated lines. So I have lines from different people. So even though they might be from the same group that came in originally, they came from different people, you know. So there's the same line as far as, you know, Montanus has there's an issue with Montanus because there's a couple different lines, and I keep the one that actually looks, I think, the best. There's some others that have a lot of high yellow in them and stuff, and I don't think they look as nice personally. They might be real Montanus, quote unquote, but they look a little different. So even within some of these subspecies, there can be different, you know, lines. I kind of want something that looks a little different than just your normal leopard gecko if I'm getting one of these different lines or whatever. Something that really represents the locality or the species very well, but just looks nice at the same time. So.
Right. No, I understand. Now, I'm curious about the Angrimanu in particular, two different locales that you have. How much distance is there between the two? And do they overlap at all, the areas?
Oh, well, like, I mean, the thing is, it's you could literally, there could be, you know, there's thousands of and thousands of localities, technically, because every time you go over a mountain ridge, there could be something different. And that's the thing, we just don't. You know, these animals stay in groups in the wild, and, you know, maybe it takes them a long time to venture anywhere as far as their genetics go. You know, over breeding of, you know, thousands of years, they probably only venture a couple mountain ranges, you know. So it's, you know, there's all these different localities, but, you know, it's really just the localities that people have actually collected them from. So, you know, I know that there's some that, you know, the ones I've gotten have been collected near the Iran and Iraq border in Kermanshah. That's one locality, but there could be, you know, a dozen between there and, you know, Kazakhstan that are significantly different, you know. So it's kind of endless in that sense. You know, I'm interested in kind of getting a sample base of, you know, I don't want like five different Kermanshah provinces. Like localities, I'd rather have something a little bit farther apart. So, like Kazakhstan is a different province altogether, same as Elam. You know, also if you go up into, you know, anywhere through the Zagros Mountains, which, you know, extends up and through Iraq, even, and, you know, there's Angermanu in Syria and Turkey, but you probably will never see those based on the countries that they're located in. There's just no way people will dare to collect them over there. So. I mean, there's literally, the localities are endless. It just depends on, like, what is collected and, you know, from what areas and what's, you know, if they go out there and they find something totally different, you know, there's highland, you can have, there's two, like, for instance, Kazakhstan, there's two provinces, or there's two variations in Kazakhstan that have been, you know, found, and one is a highland province or highland variation, one's a lowland, like from the flats. So they're actually showing up in, you know, Iran down to the lower elevations too, and then also up in the mountains. You know, Elam, for what I know, is a little bit higher elevation locality. And I've heard of them going up all the way, you know, above 1,800 meters, which I think is, you know, over 5,000 feet or 6,000 feet up. So, I mean, these animals can go pretty high in elevation as well.
Yeah, and I'm assuming the higher they go, the temperature gets cooler too. So I would think some of them can sustain cooler temperatures, possibly, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're all over the place. You know, from Angermanu, you know, I get males get lower temperature on incubating, so that kind of tells you that, you know, these animals do like. I notice they do definitely like a cooling period much more than macularis do. You know, keeping them even, like, I throw on a bulb during the day, and they get on the cold side, and they get as cold as possible right now. So I've dropped the temperatures on them and trying to keep them cool at this time of year. I think they really do actually have a pretty cold winter where they are. And, I mean, it's different from everywhere, you know. If I'm getting – but the incubation temperatures tell me that they definitely probably like a little bit cooler temperature. So.
Okay. All right. Well, as far as, you know, I understand the distinction between subspecies and species, which is good, and I think that's important that you brought that up, because I'm sure people are confused about it, and even myself, I'm learning about these because I don't follow them as closely as you do. I am impressed with them very much, though. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen in, I would say, I don't know, maybe the last 5 years, or I've been following leopard gecko stuff for the last 4.5 years or so. What was the first, let's just go with wild types, you know, to generalize, you know, the subspecies and the species. Which were the first ones that we started seeing occur in the breeders, in the leopard gecko community? Which of these guys first started making the appearance? Was it the Afghanicus?
Well, I mean, you know, most people back then, they just thought of all leopard geckos as kind of the same. So they just, you know, brought them in from Pakistan. And within Pakistan, they do look very similar. You know, that's why, you know, the variations like fasciolatus or montanus, I consider them more of localities than actually subspecies. But, you know, there has to be a lot more work. There has to be a lot more work done to distinguish those things. And, again, this is kind of the exciting part because it's never ending, really, what is found out there, you know, what they're going to find. There's new stuff being found all the time. I mean, there's new, from what I understand, there's a new species being described as we speak right now. So, I mean, there's, you know, it's kind of limitless on what we're going to end up finding in the future. In a way, these countries make it very difficult to do any of these studies, but in a way, it also keeps it, you know, it keeps it as the unknown, which makes it more of a challenge. You know, these animals are very prolific in the wild, but the problem is that, you know, these countries are so war-torn and, you know, hostile that, you know, there's no way I'm going to travel over there and try to, you know, research these things. So the studies on them have just basically come to a halt, except for a few daring individuals that'll actually go in there and do that. But, as far as the first species to be discovered, I'm not sure exactly which one they finally distinguished first. You know, they had Fuscus, I think, is labeled as the first macular species that was discovered. I forgot which scientist actually did the taxonomy on that, but I think Fuscus was the first one. I think it was originally labeled as Eublephis macularis Fuscus, which makes me think that it was probably more likely a variation of macularis at that time.
Okay.
There's been a lot of, you know, the studies on them. There's the scientists have done work in the past on them and described different animals, but part of the problem too is to know exactly what animal they were looking at that time. You know, there's even like Eublephis macularis smithii, which, you know, was from a certain area in India, which was described by two species in a museum. And it's, you know, we don't know what the we haven't had done the studies to really define that as a separate subspecies, which it quite possibly could be. I do know for a fact that macularis does extend into India quite far, though, or at least animals that are very similar to macularis. So.
Well, you've really done your homework on this, and that's what I appreciate. You know your stuff.
I dabble in a lot of different things, and I think the only thing that I'm really specialized in is, you know, the wild types of the leopard geckos, and it's kind of where I've found my interest. You know, a lot of the obscure guys that don't like all the different, you know, that don't like the macular as much, or the morphs that we create, you know, as more of a commercial breeder style, they don't like leopard geckos in general, so they kind of stay away from this stuff, and they work with other, you know, other species of geckos that are more obscure. But, you know, I find these just as fascinating, if not more, just because of their size. They're a lot larger than a lot of species of geckos out there, and they do have quite a bit of variation. So,
glad you brought that up. Let's run with that for a quick second here, John. And I've experienced that too, and I've seen it. It seems like some people, not everyone, depending on your interest, and I heard it happens between ball python guys and boa guys, you know, there seems to be, you know, almost like a fan club rivalry, you know, certain, if you like this species because it's more common than this, you're not as cool as me, or, you know, I'm cooler than you because I have this, that, and these are, you know, rarer or harder to take care for, perhaps. I don't particularly care for that attitude, because I feel like if you are fascinated by a normal leopard gecko, that's great. If you are fascinated by a viper gecko, awesome. You know, if you like the Fantasticus, that's cool. It's basically what you like. All it comes down to in the end is money. You know, what do you want to spend your money on? What do you want to buy? Where do you want to? What breeder do you want to get your animals from? What species are you interested in? So, I've seen instances where it's almost like if you'll gain more respect if you spend more money and have rarer stuff. But do you see that as a trend, or do you see that as just, you know, certain people behaving like that?
Yeah, to some extent. And, I mean, there is some credibility about that. You know, your average leopard gecko keeper isn't going to know as much about geckos as, you know, say somebody keeping some you know, fancy Europlatus or some Australian leaf-tailed type of geckos or whatever it is. But, you know, I'm fascinated with all the species of geckos. If I could keep them all, I would. You know, the bottom line, it comes down not so much even money, it comes down to time. You know, and even the big guys out there, you know, which I give a lot of respect to, you know, it was part of the thing. I got a lot, you know, I got a little bit of heat for winning the Gecko Breeder of the Year thing, but you know, I didn't even really care. I didn't really care about it, to be honest. It's one of those things that I know some of these breeders out here that have worked with, you know, 200 plus species consistently for, you know, 20, 30 years. And I mean, for me, like, I'm an amateur compared to those guys as far as that goes. I might, you know, and that's what I say is, like, you know, try to specialize in something. If you're going to go into something more obscure, go something like, you know, like for me, it was the Eublepharids. And, you know, for the next person, it might be, you know, whatever it is, Europlatus or whatever you go into, Neferus or whatever you decide, right. You know, specialize in that. And you can keep a lot of species, but nobody's going to be able to keep them all. I mean, bottom line, nobody can keep every species out there, even the guys that know, you know, almost everything about them, you know, and have gone to these countries and studied them directly. You still can't keep them all. You know, you can learn more from them, and, you know, you can I do see the fact that if you keep other species, you do learn more about even the species that you're keeping. You kind of get a broader range. So once you learn how to keep, you know, 20 species, you can almost keep, you know, anything out there, you know, successfully. You know, for me, like, you know, I got the Hemiphaeconus tailorei, which are the East African fat tails. And, you know, they're considered one of the toughest species to work with, but they're really, really cool at the same time. And, you know, a lot of people have bought them in and had troubles with them, which, you know, I'd be lying if I said they were easy. They're definitely not. But they're something that can be done, and I'm hoping that in the future I can get them going. And, I mean, you know, it's something I like, and I'm willing to put the time and effort into that. And, you know, for everybody, you just got to pick what you like and maybe work with a few obscure species, but definitely, you know, pick something you do like. And I do like the morphs, too. I mean, obviously, I work with a lot of them. You know, some of the big-time rare guys that are all into the rare species and stuff, they don't like all the morphs, and they think that's, you know, that's not the way things are supposed to be. So I kind of got both sides to me. I got, like, the purist side of it, and then I like working with the morphs. That's kind of fun, and to, you know, because you're creating something new every time, whereas
– right.
You know,
you're watching it
you're
evolve.
Working with a species, you're working with a, you know, you can get a new species, but you're not going to be creating anything new. Like, it's fun to breed two, you know, especially line breeding, where you breed two geckos together and you get something, you know, totally that's different and awesome, you know. And,
yeah,
I mean, that's the mainstream, but it's still fun, you know. I find fun in both of it. So, I mean, I'll work with...
You're lucky.
Good.
Yeah, I think you're very lucky, John, and I'm the same way where I can appreciate both. I mean, there's people out there that, like you say, they can't appreciate the morphs at all. I feel like I'm very fortunate that I can definitely appreciate both, and you can too. And me myself, I mean, I love the pure stuff, and they look great. I'd love to work with them. But to me, I have too much fun. You know, watching my projects evolve year after year, that to me is, you know, like just knowing that my vision is evolving with my selective breeding, that to me is the fun part. And, you know, that's why I prefer morph making over more natural wild type stuff. But, you know, it's good to be able to do both, I think.
Yeah, I guarantee, you know, 90% of the people that keep leopard geckos right now, if they saw, you know, an Angermanni or a Hardwicki in person, they would be hooked, you know. So it's one of those things, too, you have to really, the pictures don't do them justice as what you see in person. You know, they are unique and different, and they're very fun to work with, and it kind of satisfies that side of me too, so I can work with both. I mean, I like working with other species too. You know, I work with some Tanopus, and I work with Edura and Charactoscincus and some other species too, but, you know, for me, the wild types are where it's at. I like the big geckos that are just totally different, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit and focus, give it some time and some spotlight to E. fasciolatus in particular. And I want to start off the conversation. Last week we had Michelle on, and we were talking about E. fasciolatus, and she basically told us about a rumor that, you know, that the E. fascio may have been outcrossed at some point in Europe. And it may not be a pure subspecies, and I know that you just said that you think it's more of a locale. What do you think is going on with E. fasciolatus? Because I definitely see significant changes in projects that have Defacio blood in them, even at 25%. And what do you think's going on with them?
Well, what I like to do is I like to research the first animals that came in and kind of look at the pictures of those animals and base what was available on those animals. And the first E. fasciolatus, or E. M. fasciolatus for that matter, is, you know, it is a subspecies of macularis. So the first ones that came in were very light in color and they weren't very dark. So there's a few lines in the U.S. They all originated from the same source, which is B.C., I think it's B.C. Reptiles, a gentleman named Casper. He's not in business anymore, but they originated on an import from him in Europe. And, you know, though there's a few breeders that have them in the U.S., and some of them I don't like. I think they've been line bred, and I think they look totally different. I think they look too dark. I don't think they look like the original animals. But it's at the same time, they're still pure. So, I mean, you could technically have a like maybe the original tangerines that came in were, you know, a macularis like locality, and over time they've you know, line bred them to be tangerines. But in my opinion, that's not. I try to keep them to look exactly like they did when they first came in. You know, there's a lot of people trying to like line breed Afghans and line breed different things. And my thought is that I look at the original animals and I see, like, whatever looks closest to those original animals is what I go for now. So for me, that's what's interesting. If you do something else, like if you're line breeding something for maybe you get, I've seen some subspecies that have been line bred for dark coloration. If you do that, then keep the line separate and just say like a dark line bred, you know, Montanus or whatever you're doing, you know. I hatch out even out of my pure stuff. I hatch out all kinds of, you know, stuff that I could line breed and totally make it into something new. But I kind of pick the middle ground. And I go from there. So I kind of try to keep things, you know, like in Montanus, for instance, they're very light. You know, the original ones that came in were extremely light in color, at least the line that I have. And, you know, I'm trying to go for that. You know, some of them, I hatch out a few Montanus that are extremely dark, and that's just, you know, over time they kind of get line bred to a different variation. So. Yeah, fasciolatus, I mean, there's a few different lines that came from the original same source, but, you know, some of them I like and some of them I personally don't, just because they don't look like the original ones anymore.
Okay, I haven't really seen too many of the dark ones. Mine all come, well, my females come from Marcia and my male came from Nigel, who I believe got his from Sykes, so, you know, I guess I have some diversity there, and they all have that light cream color with a more like lavender highlights in it. So I would think those are the.
And the thing is, they come from the original bloodlines. I know both of those bloodlines are legitimate. You know, but you can also get animals that, you know, go back the other way again. So they kind of go dark, or some of the animals go dark, some don't. So you can go back the other way. So. You know, okay. I know Marshes are very nice, and they're. I mean, I'm not going to name names or anything on the show, but you know, there are some that, you know, I don't like as much. Just in my opinion, I just think they just don't look like the original ones that came in.
That's fair.
But I've seen many nice ones from Marcia. You know, I've gotten some from Steve Sykes. I've gotten some other places too, and I have my preference on which ones I have after seeing them in person.
Okay, so you do have some fascio project going on currently?
Yeah, I breed fasciolata. I breed everything. So, I mean, I breed fasciolatus, macularis. I consider a locality. It was sold to me as a macularis, but, I mean, that is a broad definition. You know, and the thing with macularis is all these are kind of, you know, it's so unknown about really, like, the specifics on them. I've seen a lot of Montanus animals from the wild and that their actual location, so that pretty much seems legitimate to me. You know, fasciolatus is more of a coastal variation from what I understand, and, you know, they do have that lighter color. So they're kind of in between a macularis, and a macularis Montanus.
Okay. So, all right. Well, that's fair.
But,
nobody
knows all the specifics of this stuff. This stuff is, you know, so unknown. Even, you know, a lot of guys working with Angrimonu these days, like the biologists that I would talk to a lot, they want to study the macularis and all the localities, but they can't just because of the country. So, you know, we're kind of limited on what we know. So,
yeah, hopefully in the future things will change.
But yeah, slowly over time we'll get it. But
Do you did you do any outcrossing with E. fasciolatus into any of your own morphs at all?
I haven't done it myself. I don't. I think I have some stuff. I think I got some from you that were outcrossed, and I got some other stuff, but I haven't done too much of that yet. I don't have a lot of fasciolatus. I have a lot of Tyrannicus and Montanus, but I don't have too many fasciolatus that I'm, you know, I definitely wouldn't be using a female to outcross at this point, maybe a male, but, you know, for me, I like outcrossing with Turkmanicus, to be honest, just because of the genetics are so far apart, and they do breed with maculators fine. And it seems like the animals that come from Turkmanicus are extremely strong, every one of them. So most of the, like, my marble eye outcrosses this year will be with Turkmanicus for the most part.
Nice.
Yeah, Montanus is, you know, they're a little bit, they're like a lanky, like, Angrimani, like a smaller, lanky Angrimani kind of variation. They almost seem like, and, you know, they do range into eastern Iran, so, you know, they could be kind of linked up there at some point, you know.
All right. But, let's, I would think in popularity in the gecko community today, it seems that it's the fasciolatus, it's the Montanus, and, of course, it's the Afghanicus. Why don't we jump into the Afghanicus a little bit? I've seen some incredibly dark examples of the Afghanicus, and then I've seen some really, you know, yellow and black ones, and then I've seen Afghanicus that have some bold head markings going on. And you know, when I see that in a wild type or a subspecies, so to speak, I see what may be affecting some of the morphs that we have. And I don't know if, what is your opinion on, like, sometimes when I see Afghanicus with bald head markings, I think, well, maybe that's how, you know, the bandit morph got some of that trait. Somewhere along the line there had some of that blood that just linked up right. What are your feelings on, and let's not get too off on a tangent, but what are your feelings on Afghanicus, and what do you think about it possibly influencing something like the bandit way in the past?
I don't think it has anything to do with the bandit personally, but, you know, it could, you know, some of that stuff could be in there. I think with a lot of these subspecies, a lot of people think like Angrimani would be part of the supergiant line and stuff because of the size. And what I always refer back to is like the body shape and the way the animal actually looks. And, you know, they have totally two different body structures. And same with Afghanicus. They're very small. They have a very like stouty, long torso with very short legs, you know, the real ones at least.
Right.
You know, they have a different body structure than maculators. So, I mean, as far as the bandits that I've seen, you know, I've never seen really bandits with that body structure or any influence of that body structure. So for me, I just don't see it being as part of the influence in the background. And after breeding macularis for, you know, enough years like I have, I've noticed that you can create all kinds of stuff from just macularis. I mean, it changes almost as quickly, you know, if not quicker than almost like dogs do, you know, as far as how quick they can change in coloration, you know, from line to line. Mm-hmm. And anybody that has ever bred a group of leopard geckos, you know, that you get all kinds of stuff from the same pairing. So, I mean, I've hatched out all kinds of crazy stuff from, you know, one pairing that can be totally different. And I think it's just kind of, you know, came from macularis, and, you know, over time it's changed. They change pretty quickly, you know, year increments between breeding cycles, and you just, you know, literally you can influence these animals dramatically within a couple of years in the color and pattern and, you know, anything pretty much.
I agree on that, absolutely.
Yeah, I think everything pretty much came from Pakistan when it originally came in. So I think pretty much everything we got was, you know, Pakistan animals. Not somewhat, you know, Afghanicus come from like the mountains in southern, southeastern, like Afghanistan, you know, that very unlikely that they went and collected the animals there when they're very prolific in Pakistan like that. So,
Okay.
Don't,
so now with the Afghanicus, they're pretty popular today with breeders, and we often see. I know you have feelings about this, and that's why I'm going to bring it up. We often see Afghan Raptors offered for sale. We see Afghan this, Afghan that. Tell us your opinion on that, and also expand a little bit on Afghanicus in general and what your experiences are working with them.
Well, I don't see any problem with that kind of stuff. I don't do it as much as other people or probably as interested as it in other people might be. But, you know, okay. I have Afghan tangerines. I have, you know, some stuff that's crossed that I think looks really cool. But the second the second it gets bred into a morph or to another, you know, macularis, it becomes a morph to me. It goes into a different category. It's not a wild type no more. Yeah, it has a different blood, and it strengthens the line. And, you know, of course that's good to strengthen the line. But the second you breed it into your tangerines or you breed it into your bold stripes or whatever it is, it becomes a morph at that point. And if you're gonna label it Afghan tangerine or Afghan bold or Afghan hauling mounts, whatever you're gonna do with it, you gotta tell the person like how much, you know, bloodline it has from the Afghan. So, you know, first cross would be 50% Afghan. You know, 50% bold or whatever morph you bred it into. If you bred that animal back into a bold again the next year, you got to say 25%. You can't say 50% no more. Well, a lot of people don't label that. They just say Afghan bold, you know. So pretty soon you get down to, you know, like 6% Afghan blood, and they're still labeling it as Afghan bolds. And, you know, I just think that's kind of deceiving to people. The other thing, I mean, if you're breeding Afghan bold to Afghan bold, and then, you know, that are 50-50, then, yeah, you can still label it as 50% Afghan blood. But, you know, I don't find any problem with doing that. I don't do it so much. I only do it to strengthen lines. And if there is something really cool that pops out from them, like, you know, for me, you know, like I did Jim Snow Montanus crosses that came out really cool looking just because my Montanus has a very wide appearance already. So I did that, and I'll do like Afghan stuff cross because they have kind of a unique look. And then I also do them to strengthen lines, like just like the Marpali and other things. I know some people are doing like the Angermanu like crosses with, you know, super giants and stuff. For me right now, I don't want to do that just because I'm not interested in, you know, I would consider Angermanu more of a linebred size thing, and maybe super giant is either being recessive in my opinion or line bred. And I don't want to mix those at this point. Maybe later on I'll do it, but for me it's, you know, some people are looking to make a dollar off them real quick and, you know, breed them into that and see what happens. And I think it's fine. It's just not what I'm into totally. I'm more into keeping
them
pure at this point.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I can see there's something different about the Angermanus. Like, I can see the Fascia crosses, the Afghan crosses, and the Montanus, of course. But then there's something just very special about the Angermanus that I think, I don't know, I just can't see the point of mixing it with a morph, in my opinion. But, you know, I just think
that's... I mean, I can see it. I can see the temptation, and I can see what people like out of it, and I have no problem.
Right.
It's just I don't want to do it. That's just me. So...
Yeah.
The people that are doing it out there, I don't, you know, that's fine. But
for me,
it's just, like, I like to keep them pure. Like, my Angermanu are 100% pure, and it's very rare in the world to have, you know, pure Angermanu as far as localities and stuff. So that's why I don't have all the localities yet, is because a lot of them I'm not sure about. You know, a lot of them, I verify the sources down to the person that went and collected them or the biologist that looked at them, and, you know, I don't want to mess with anything that's, you know, cross between stuff. You know, it's one thing, you know, some of these animals are still unrelated, but, you know, you can get, some people have the thought process of, well, I'm going to cross all the Angermanu provinces and mix them together and they're going to be a stronger animal. Well, they might be a little bit, but, you know, now you made a mutt, you know, just like a mutt macularis is the same thing. It's a mutt Angermanu, so. I'm not saying that's wrong. That's just what some people want to do, and that's fine if they want to do that. For me, that's not what I want to do.
No, I get it. Yeah, I'm not knocking. I'm just saying, yeah, it's, you know, I just think they're very special and just the way they are kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. They're amazing. I mean, for me, they're perfection. You can't, You know, I have Fusus and Hardwicke, which are kind of the holy grails, you know, leopard geckos, and I probably like Angamanu, if not more, just as much, you know. You know, Fusus is pretty cool, too, but, yeah,
They have a really, I don't know what kind of, I wouldn't call it a sinister look, the Fusus, but they have a very striking appearance, that's the word. You know, just really, I don't know. Something just really special about
them. Well, you know, books always stated them as being, you know, huge. Like, what we think happened is that they measured, the original scientists that looked at them, they measured snout to vent. Or they measured snout to tail, and they labeled it down as snout to vent. So we thought these animals were just absolutely massive, like little monitors, basically, roaming around the east, you know, western Pakistan. And, you know, it turns out they're about the same size as a Macularis, but unfortunately, that would have been, you know, the ultimate if they would have been that big, they would have been one of the largest gecko species in the world, you know, close to, you know, the Lychianus and all these other species, you know, could have gotten close to record breaking, but, you know, it was just a, you know, original scientist going in there and marking down the wrong information in the wrong spot made us think that for a long time. up until we recently got the animals in, you know, we didn't know for sure about that. There is a slight possibility that the original descriptions too were a bit different animal of a locality that was much bigger, but that's very unlikely based on the two animals in that area are Macularis and Fusus. So it's very unlikely that anything was bigger.
Okay. All right. Well, we're at the halfway point here. We're going to take our break. And in the second half of the show, we are going to open up the phone lines to everybody. And John wants to give away a gift to a caller tonight. We'll do a raffle. For people that call in with their questions, we'll do a raffle after the show tomorrow. And, John, what did you want to give to the listener, to a caller?
Yeah, I think it was $50 off any purchase over $200 or $200
right.
or more. Doesn't apply to old, you know, purchases already in progress or what was the other thing? $50 off.
Right, yeah, $50 off anything over $200 or more, it doesn't apply to any
It was no other discounts included. So if, like, somebody called or messaged me up and said they wanted something, or I gave them a better price than what's advertised, it's not off of that.
Gotcha, okay, just so everybody's clear, that's the fine print. All right, we will be back in 1 minute. Hang tight, everybody, for more on wild types and subspecies and extra species and all kinds of crazy stuff with John Scarborough. And if I could find the sponsor plug, that would be great. And right here.
Gecko Nation Radio is a David's Fine Geckos creation and production. You can visit the show's Facebook page at Gecko Nation Radio. I also have a great family-friendly group on Facebook called Gecko Nation. Apply for membership today. Gecko Nation Radio is sponsored by...
Rainbow Mealworms is the largest worm grower in the world and selling to the public since 1956. If you need the highest quality mealworms, superworms, and crickets for your pests, contact them at www.rainbowmealworms.net.
Gecko Boa Reptiles is your source for the highest quality leopard gecko morphs and wild types, from white and yellows to radars, amazing tremper morphs, and rare subspecies. John is a world-class breeder and extremely knowledgeable. If you're looking for something truly special in geckos, contact John Scarborough at geckoboa.com and on Facebook. abdragons.com is your source for the highest quality dubia roaches, whether you're starting a colony of your own or just need feeders for your insect-eating herps. abdragons.com can't be beat in quality or price. They are also a huge distributor of FlexWatt reptile heat tape and have very competitive pricing. Check out abdragons.com online and on Facebook. Dale's Bearded Dragons is your one-stop source for any reptile supply products that you may need, from Exoterra, Zoomed, Rapashi, Repcal, Fluker, and much, much more, and all at 20 to 50% cheaper than your local pet store or big chain pet store. They are also the biggest reptile supply distributor at most of the Northeast Expos. Contact them directly online at dalesbeardeddragons.com or message me on Facebook and I'll put you in touch with the owner. And if you're looking for quality food for your dubia roaches, crickets, mealworms, and superworms, look no further than MS2 Premium Insect Chow. Made with reptiles in mind, it contains no dog food, cat food, or chicken mash. Using only vegetable proteins and high-quality ingredients, MS2 Premium Insect Chow will have your feeders making a beeline for it. Contact ms2ent.weebly.com, or it can also be purchased at Rainbow Mealworms and AB Dragons.
Okay, everybody. I'd also like to mention at this time that we do have two other sponsors, three that just came on board. We have Thad from Ohio Gecko, ohiogecko.com, awesome source for fat tails and incredible tangerines. Check out ohiogecko.com. Also, supremegecko.com. Wally is known for Cresties. If you guys like Cresties and small bay geckos and micro geckos and all kinds of really interesting obscure types, Wally's got them. And it does some work with Leos, too. So definitely check out supremegecko.com. And last of our newest sponsor is reptilesexpress.com. They are the best reptile shipping company and also has the best customer service. So www.reptilesexpress.com. Give them a try. Call Debbie if you have never shipped before. She will help you get through it and make it a fun and easy experience. And they also sell a bunch of shipping supplies on their website. All right. We're going to also, one last thing, Herpentine Radio and Gecko Nation Radio are a team as far as promoting go. And Herpentine is also my inspiration to start Gecko Nation Radio. So I'd like you guys to take advantage of this other reptile-related show that's out there. And they do a lot of great interviews with some amazing people. So definitely check out Herpentine Radio. It's on Blog Talk as well, and that's on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Okay? All right, we're going to open up the phone lines now, and this is your time to call in with your questions. And John is extending a special credit tonight for callers. What we'll do is, for people that call in with their questions, I'll keep track of everyone who calls, and tomorrow afternoon I will do a raffle and put those people's names in the raffle, and I'll announce the winner in the Gecko Nation group, okay? And the winner will receive a $50 credit towards any purchase of $200 or more. So if you're looking forward to getting something really cool, maybe one of his Macularis or Afghanicus or Montanus or whatever he's posting, he's got amazing tangerines, all kinds of great stuff, then this will be your chance to get a little bit of a break on the price. So take advantage, call in. We love callers, and get some questions going. All right, we are back with John, and we already have a caller on the line from area code 432, and I think I know who this is. Caller from the 432 area code, you're live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Hi, Dave. Hi, John. This is Daryl. How y'all doing today?
Hey, Daryl.
Hey, Daryl.
Good.
Dave, you need to make sure and put my name in there several times because, you know, I need that $50 from John.
No problem. I can't rig the contest, but I'll say a couple extra prayers and hope you win. How's that?
There you go. Hey, John, I'm like you. You know, I guess I'm old school, and I really like the species stuff and, you know, the subs as well. And I tend to go right down the line with you. I like the Turkmanicus probably the best and the Montanus. But my question, you kind of hit on it already. I was wondering if there was any field work being done, you know, as far as trying to figure out the agamanius and the stuff like that. But I realize with the, you know, those countries being in the shape they're in, that it's kind of tough. But I figure there's somebody doing it. And
there are a couple, there's a lot of people interested. And I do know certain individuals that are actually taking a look at some of the animals that you're talking about. You know, it kind of depends on the country. You know, Syrian Angermanu and Turkish Angermanu are going to be next to impossible at this point. So, I mean, you're almost
suicidal if you're going to go in those countries and try to do that. So
exactly.
Iran and Iraq, there's probably a little more leeway there where they're able to look into these countries, especially like, you know, the Zagros Mountains where Iran is. That's how we're able to see these species right now, is because it isn't as hard. There's also some people looking into, you know, hopefully soon into Turkmenistan and like some of the Turkmenicus, and, you know, India's, you know, you got to look out. If people are going out there to look at leopard geckos, you know, you got to look out for rangers and you got to look out for tigers. So, I mean, they're taking their own risks there. So,
I mean, exactly.
There are people that are definitely interested in this stuff. And, I mean, most of them are overseas. You know, I don't think there's anybody in the U.S. that's really actively too interested in this stuff or willing to go to these countries. I mean, I'd love to go to these countries myself even, you know, and I almost would, you know, even try it, but it's just, for me, being a 6'4 white dude and from the U.S., it's just suicidal to even try to go look at these countries. And
exactly.
Just not going to be doing it anytime soon. But there are, you know, where I get my anger on you, or where I've gotten most of mine, you know, is actually a biologist that studies the phylogenetics of these animals too. And, you know, so I'm actually getting animals that are part of studies, you know, that have been done on the species. So, you know, it's an ongoing process. You know, we're learning more and more. A lot of locals take pictures of animals. A lot of amateur photographers and even professional photographers in India, they take pictures of animals, and slowly over time, we're getting pictures of animals in different localities, and we're kind of understanding, you know, what they look like at different areas. So that's partly how we have to do the research on them, is just after random people taking pictures of them. And, you know, I get literally a person in Pakistan every week emailing me about animals he has for sale because they have this big nation.
Oh, me
that,
too.
You know,
oh,
yeah,
really?
It's I don't know where they're getting the motivation. Some of them say they're selling animals, so I don't know where they're sending them to, probably China. But, you know, they think the bigger the animals, the more it's worth, which is sad too, because I've seen them actually put, you know, on some they'll actually go out there and put, you know, spray paint a monitor and put gecko eyes on a monitor, glue them on to a monitor, and actually try to sell them to us as large leopard geckos because they think we want these giant leopard geckos. And it's just sad because they're doing this to these animals. And, you know, I've been getting pictures lately where, you know, they obviously stuff the stomachs of these animals heavy with something. You know, their stomach is just, you know, bloated and full of either shot or something. I don't know, but it's sad the animal's not even moving at all. And they're trying to sell it to me as a 300-gram leopard gecko. And I'm just like, please stop. Please
exactly.
Tell all your friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do not want, I don't want it from like a random person in, you know, Pakistan. I'd rather a biologist go through there and do studies and, you know, DNA tests and then, you know, figure out the science on these animals. I know they're not endangered, but it's at the same time, it's sad that they're doing these things to these animals that, you know, they're like that.
Absolutely. Well, you get some of these places like that where if they can sell a few of those animals to somebody in Europe or wherever, you know, they can make enough money to live on for a year.
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem.
Of course. They think it's big money and, you know, they want to make a buck and they're trying to feed their family. I understand that. But, you know, we got to not support it. And I tell every one of them to, like, I make it a point. I think a lot of people won't even email them back, but I make it a point to tell them to stop doing it and to not tell their friends to do it because it's kind of an epidemic in Pakistan. And it's gotten to the point where it's, you know, the government's like gotten involved a little bit. And, you know, besides it being illegal, you can't just bring these animals in from Pakistan like that.
Sure.
You know, you're risking them being big trouble for that even, you know, and
sure.
you're probably going to lose your money or whatever. It's just, you know, it's sad because there's, you know, all these people trying to do this now. Hey, it's a big rumor that spread through that country.
Steve did a story about this a while ago. I think the title was called The Sale Export of Leopard Geckos from Pakistan Condemned or something. Something like that. It's going back in the shows. But,
yeah.
Like you said, John, they are aware of it, at least. And, You know, I made a point to say, there's somebody buying them. We don't need your leopard geckos. We've got enough here.
Yeah, I've already talked to people that over there. They said that people are buying them, and so there's somebody that's buying them, whether it's Europe or whether it's, you know.
How many do you think, in some of these outlying places like that that we can't get to, do you think there's some other undescribed species that are around that we just hadn't seen yet?
Oh, yeah. I know for a fact there's a lot. So I know people that have, you know, there's different areas of these countries where there definitely is, you know, at least different localities or subspecies. And, you know, like I said earlier, there's even a species being described right now that's different from all of them. So, you know, it's not limitless, but there's definitely a lot of different localities and different variations and, you know, maybe just as much as, you know, how Macularis macularis or like our regular leopard gecko looks compared to a Afghanicus, you know, for instance, you know, it might be that kind of variation that we're talking about, but, you know, which I consider a new species anyway.
Sure.
Interesting. All right. Great. Any other questions, Carol, while we have you?
I think that's it. I can't wait to see the things I have coming from John next week, so I'll be sure and be posting some pictures of those when I get them.
Yeah.
So anyway, John, I appreciate all you do, and you too, Dave. Everything's going great.
Of course. Thanks, bud. I appreciate your support.
Yeah, you bet. And we'll be talking again, I'm sure.
Cool. Hey, all right, Darryl. Sounds good, Darryl. Thanks for calling in, bud.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yep. All right, Darryl's a cool guy. Keep an eye on what Darryl's doing, everybody. Got some got some really nice stuff going on. All right. Wow, we got a bunch of callers here. All right, let's go ahead and take caller from the 253 area code. You're live on Gecko Nation Radio. How's it going, caller?
Hey, how you doing? This is Ulta Borzoi, Dave and Don.
Hi, Ulta.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm really still a beginner with leopard geckos, but I'm fascinated with their history and everything. I was wondering what is the easiest for a beginner to work with in the subspecies? Like, would it be Afghanicus or Fuscus or which one?
Good question.
I'd probably say either, like, you know, you could go to subspecies like Fasciolatus. It's pretty easy. All of them are fairly easy as far as the scale of and keeping geckos in general. So, I mean, they're not hard species in general. Anything that's an arid environment, something that survives, like, you know, extremely high temperatures in the day and low temperatures at night and limited water and humidity, most of those types of species are going to be pretty bulletproof. But I would say, you know, for my work with right now, I mean, Fuscus seems to be one of the strongest species I've ever worked with. You know, honestly, I can't. These geckos took shipment from Europe better than any gecko I've ever received. So, I mean, from my limited animals that I have on those, I mean, they're looking like they're one of the strongest species out there. And from what I've heard from other people that have them now, too, it's the same thing. They're still extremely priced. Go ahead.
Is that the Hardwickii?
No, that's the Fuscus. That's the Hardwickii are eastern India, and then Fuscus are western India.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. But the Fuscus seem to be closer related to Macularis than Hardwickii. Hardwickii seems to be more of a distant species. Attitude is very similar to Macularis on Fuscus, but they seem to be one of the strongest species, for sure.
Okay.
But they are still very pricey. I mean, they're extremely rare.
Right.
But, you know, as far as the more common ones, Afghanicus is a very easy species to take care of and keep, and they even do pretty well in groups. They do. I keep most of mine in groups, you know, and I've always found that they do very well in groups. So they're one of the funner ones that are a little bit less expensive, you know, to work with.
Right.
Turkmanicus and Montanus are a little bit more difficult. They tend to only want insect prey like roaches or crickets. Whereas, you know, Afghanicus, you can pretty much get them going on anything.
Okay.
But
Thank you so much.
If you're gonna get a subspecies to start off, maybe Afghanicus or fasciolatus, then those two might be good to start off. Or anything that you find macularis, those are all
okay.
Good too.
Thank you very much.
Sure, no problem.
Okay, thanks, Elsa. All right, we have a few more calls here. Let's take the caller from who's been on the longest here. Caller from the 530 area code, you are live on Gecko Nation Radio.
I am. You hear me?
Sir.
All right, how's it going? Hey, this is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff, what's up, bud?
I got a question for John.
Sure.
Yeah. I called the right place in, huh?
Yes.
Hold on.
Maybe
sorry,
not.
I just by accident. No, you did. Go ahead.
What'd I do, man? anyway, the Afghanicus, a friend of mine was over there in Afghanistan, and he was telling me, I don't know if it's a question or just a comment, or I'll just share what I heard. He was mm-hmm. telling me over in Afghanistan, though the geckos that lived up in the higher rocky places were like a darker color than the ones that were more in the, poppy-filled grassy land kind of area, in which those were a little, the yellows were brighter in those ones than in the rocky
sense.
Areas. So I just wanted to hear any input you had on any of that.
Yeah, from what I understand is most of the Afghanicus we have come from the higher elevations. I've seen pictures of lower elevation ones, and they look a little bit more like your regular macularis, so that might be why. I have two different lines of Afghanicus, and, the ones that are F1s that I got in recently are very, very dark. So I like the darker look if that's the higher elevation. I mean, that's...
Yeah,
maybe a little news to me, as far as that goes. But I see the variations between lower elevations and higher elevations to be pretty significant, no matter where you're at. So same thing. That's why I was talking about, like, Kazakhstan, Iran. The Angermanu vary very much so from the lower elevation to the higher elevation. Not all the animals can survive. I mean, as any time you have a higher elevation, it's a different climate. So. It's not like the species is going to venture back and forth so often, or at least going to take on a different appearance. So,
John?
Well,
temperature, maybe
temperature,
food source,
maybe
or
of it, but I mean, I think who knows? Maybe the type of camouflage that they need at higher elevation is a darker type of camouflage, or lowland is more maybe a sandy type of lighter color. That could be part of it over,
And they've just
years.
Evolved over, millennium
exactly.
or whatever.
Exactly.
So yeah, I noticed it here, too, with, gopher snakes. Higher up here where I'm at, they tend to be a darker color, and then I go further down into, like, the valley, like Sacramento Valley or closer to the valley in there. They're more of a reddish-orange color. I'm kind of comparing that with, what goes on over there.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's – and then you go by the ocean, and the gopher snakes you see there are a lot darker, which
yeah,
I don't
– Yeah, it's amazing that any of these little things will – those animals won't survive just because of the slight variation in them.
Keep evolving. Stronger ones make it with the better camouflage and whatever.
Exactly. Same reason that you don't see many albinos. That's why I kind of picked out that
albino
day gecko, because that's not likely ever to happen.
I thought about that.
It's so unheard of.
A day gecko out in the day and an albino getting the sunlight? Yeah, and I thought, that dog don't hunt.
there's just too many things going against an albino to survive in the wild. So, that's why you might see a few, but you'll see a lot more hets than you will actual visuals. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, that was kind of my input on the whole thing, and kind of wanted to cover that ground.
Yeah,
no, that's cool.
Me too. I mean, I haven't talked to anybody in Afghanistan that's actually, and that's how we have to get our information, is talking to these people that are actually you know, I've gotten information from people deployed in Iraq even and stuff, even the past.
Yeah, he was deployed over there and just off hiking around doing whatever, shooting people or whatever they do. And was interested in reptiles and kind of shared that with me, so I thought I'd kind of throw that out there, see what kind of other input.
Yeah,
cool. Well, I appreciate it, Jeff. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, not a problem. Thanks for taking my call.
All right. Take care, bud.
Bye.
Bye now. All right. We've got a couple more here. Let's take the caller from the 630 area code. You're live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Hello.
Hello. Who's this?
Hello.
This is Carla. I just had a question for John.
Sure, Carla.
I'm fairly new to geckos, and I really like the bigger subspecies, and I was wondering, I don't know if you've talked about this before, which one is the bigger one, the Turkmenicus or the Ingermanius?
Well, Turkmenicus and Afghanicus are a little bit smaller. Afghanicus is probably the smallest of all of them. Where Turkmenicus is maybe second. And when you're talking about subspecies, usually we're talking about macularis. So that would be the biggest in macularis would actually probably be macularis. But the biggest of all your blepharids or leopard geckos in general would be Angomania for sure. We get, you know, those, I posted on my Facebook page, but, you know, I hatched out babies that were 12 gram eggs and 12 gram babies when they hatched.
Wow.
You know, just dwarfing the 2 and 3 gram leopard gecko babies that we hatch. So, I mean, it's just a significant difference from the get-go. I haven't raised the Angermanu from baby to adult yet, you know, because they take longer to raise. You know, you're looking 2 to 3 years at least to breed. And I'm seeing that like 3 years to get more to their full size. So we'll see how, you know.
I have plenty of time, but I really like the look of the subspecies.
Yeah, I mean, if you want big, you're looking for Angermanu. I mean, they're huge. Their heads are massive. They're more of a lanky gecko, like long and lanky, so they don't get the heavy gram weights.
Right.
But like, if you were comparing, 120 gram Angermanu to super giant, macularis, you'd probably be looking at like 180, 190 gram macularis compared to like body structure. So they just stay lighter, but they get bigger is basically what I'm saying. So they're a cool species altogether just to work with.
That's all I needed. That's what I needed for my question. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah. Literally, all right, like my macularis heads are like almost as big as my toke heads are. So it's like crazy
wow.
How big they are. Yeah.
Wow.
They're just huge.
Thank you very much.
All right, Carla.
Sure.
Thank you. All right. I think we have a familiar number here. Seems familiar. Let's see. Caller from the 907 area code. You're live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Hey there, it's Marcy.
Marcy.
Hey, Marcy.
What's up, Marcy?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. I'm feeling a little better than I have been, so that's really good news.
Oh, is the roach chow going out the door or what?
The roach chow's going out the door. My husband was, I don't know if everybody saw on my wall, I had a funny posed picture of my husband laying next to boxes and boxes of roach chow. And but literally he was burning the midnight oil, so to speak, getting everything ready for him going back to work and me not being able to do much of anything. So he did an outstanding job. I have to give him big kudos for that because it was an interesting adventure. I'm like
cool.
16, 17 days out of my surgery, and I feel much better. But I just wanted to tell John that I appreciate all the information he helps me with. I purchased some absolutely glorious Turkmenicus from him as well as some other geckos that just, you know, steal my heart. And my most exciting, I guess, how do I say it? The most exciting purchase that I'm going to make this year is going to be some of his newer line Afghanicus. And just because Afghanicus are my truly favorite subspecies of all. For some reason, I'm a complete dork for Afghanicus. So I've really expanded my collection, and that's kind of where my heart is with subspecies, them being my favorite, but also just loving subspecies in general.
Yeah, cool. Afghans are definitely cool, you know. Setting them up in the group is fun, too, because they have a lot of behavior. The males really get some crazy behavior if you put them up in a big group. They really are rubbing their paws everywhere they go and just almost walking sideways, how much they display that. So they're interesting for sure.
Well, I definitely am looking forward to one of the things that I'd like to do is to be able to set up, I'm trying to think of my numbers now. I think I've got like 27 Afghanicus right now. So it'd be fun to figure out who to set up and in what colonies, and not quite ready to do that yet because it would take more manpower than I'm able to, but I think that'd be something that I'd really enjoy because you don't get too many of the geckos that I feel comfortable about putting them together in a colony. But just the Afghanicus just seems just so incredible. I mean, they're just so sweet. They're literally, it's like my sweet spot, my heart, you know. I have them, ones that I just sit and hold, and they just are just sweet and gentle, and I'm in love with them, so.
Yeah, and the new line even look better, and they're just the same attitude, too. So, you know, they almost seem
the Angermanus there?
What's that?
Did you say the Angermanus there?
No, the new line of Afghanicus. So,
oh,
you know,
okay.
They seem to be even a little smaller than the ones that have been in the U.S. for a while. So they definitely have that same attitude, if not even more.
Well, that's so exciting. I cannot wait. That's probably my most exciting purchase this year is going to be those, as well as hopefully some ankle menus if I can get in there first.
Okay.
I know you've got a long list, and understandably so, because, you know, I just have to say that I'm extraordinarily proud of all the work you've done to bring some incredible subspecies into our community, and also the information that you bring in as well.
Yeah, no problem.
It's
what I enjoy, so I like sharing it too. You know, it's not a lot of information easily found out there, so I don't share every bit of detail that I know, but I share as much as I can.
Yeah, well, you're definitely very helpful, especially for someone who doesn't know much, you know, and they fall in love with the subspecies, and you're definitely have always been a good resource, like in shows like this, where you explain a lot of information. So it's something that is appreciated.
What's your IQ, John?
I don't even know. I did one of those little online tests, and I got like a 160, but I don't think that's totally accurate. I don't think I'm that high.
But, no, he's pretty smart, Marcy. I've had some conversations with him, and even last night he helped me tell me some cool husbandry tricks of his that are just, you know, like, why didn't I think of that? But, yeah, he knows what he's talking about. That's for sure. Do you have any other questions, Mark?
John definitely earned my respect over the past, you know, short period of time that I've been involved in geckos, and you know, there's a lot to be said for the kind of caliber of person that John is. So if anybody out there has not purchased a gecko from Gecko Boa, I suggest you go look at the website, there are very, very few people that I say without hesitation, buy with confidence, absolutely stellar, impressive, and John is one of those people. And so if you're looking to get into subspecies, or if you're looking to get into, you know, some of his other extraordinary tangerines, or, you know, any of that, I mean, he's just got so many gorgeous geckos. You know, if you're looking to take that leap, I would say without, you know, any hesitation that John is one of the good men to go to for that.
Yep. Definitely. I agree.
Thanks, 100%. Marcy. Thanks, Marcy. Yeah. Appreciate it.
No problem. Well, I'm going to go because I don't have a whole lot to say, and I'm probably still a little – I'm just not with it. I'm just not myself. So,
okay, we'll get better, Marcy.
But I just had to say thank you, and thank you for inspiring me to absolutely love subspecies. And it's probably gotten me in trouble with my husband just a little bit, but I think I have to figure out, like, new different recipes and, you know, all kinds of tricks. Like, we made a Valentine's burger for my son. My husband was like, oh, my gosh, I wish I was home. Filled with blue cheese,
right,
fried mushrooms, onions, hollandaise sauce on toasted buns. And so
whatever gets you those geckos,
those little things like that are the things that keep me out of trouble when I buy geckos.
Okay. All right. All right, Marcy. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank
better.
You. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. We hope Marcy gets well. She's recovering from surgery, so hope you get better, Marcy. All right. Okay, it looks like the callers are done, John. I do have a few more questions for you, though. You know, Matt, you know, we have all these subspecies and species that we have with leopard geckos. They, you know, we have them defined basically by their Latin names. And, you know, of course, Euboflaris macularis macularis is our common leopard gecko. Do you think in the future these Latin names will get... Well, these geckos have become common enough where people will start giving them, or they'll just they'll be given common names, or do you think they're always just going to be described as by their Latin names?
Well, most of them have common names anyway. You would say, you know, you basically, all these are leopard geckos by description. So you would say, like, Angelmani would be the Iranian leopard gecko if it was collected in Iran. Or, you know, Indian, like the Fuscus and Hardwicki, there's East Indian leopard gecko and West Indian leopard gecko. But for the most part, the people that are interested in the stuff, they're going to go with the Latin name, which is, you know, the scientific name adds more depth to the, you know, a lot of people don't understand this, but it adds more depth to what the animal is, because sometimes you can have, you know, people don't realize how many different species there are of geckos out there. I mean, if you don't have really a good way to classify each one of them, you know, it's hard to really know what you're talking about, you know. So, like, you know, rather than calling them all leopard gecko, we call them all these different names because that's how they're described. And I mean, for me, I don't see it ever going away. I think it's always going to be there because that's what it's known as, you know? So, I mean, you could say Iranian leopard gecko if you want, but I mean, there's, you know, most people that are into a Angelmani are not going to care, you know, they're going to know it either way. So,
gotcha.
I think it's going to stay.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah. You know,
okay.
Leopard gecko.
We have a caller here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a caller here. I could take a call from the 801 area code. You're live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Oh, hey, guys. This is Tristan. I'm new to the show.
Hi, Tristan.
Hey. I had a question for John. I've been breeding leopard geckos for a couple of years now, and I just got started on subspecies, and I just wanted to know, what is the best to get started on?
Okay, that's a good question. Which of the subspecies?
Well, it comes down to what you can spend, first of all, because you're going to
a few species out there that are pretty expensive still. Second of all, like, whatever you're into, you know, do some research about it and find out what you like. If you like, you know, what a Afghanicus looks like, then go for that, or go for, you know, I get a lot of questions about what morph I should breed or what I should do with this or that, and it's, you know, it's, they all have their advantages. There's a lot of people like, you know, patternless morphs. There's a lot of people like a lot of coloration and you know, patterns to animals. And, I mean, it comes down to what you like. And, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of research to figure out, you know, what is what. You know, if you spend 2 hours, you could probably figure out everything that you would, you know, be looking at and kind of decide from there. I mean, you know, it's – just do a little research and figure out what you like. I like them all. You know, I don't, there's not one that I don't like. The lower price ones, I like Afghanicus a lot, you know, to be honest. But, I mean, that just varies on, you know, personal preference. You know, they're very small. They stay a lot smaller than the other leopard geckos or other subspecies. But, you know, just it varies on what you like. If I had all the money, if I could only keep one for the rest of my life, it'd probably be just Anne Grimani. But, you know, I can keep them all, so I keep them all.
Yeah.
Right.
I think I'm leaning more towards Afghanicus, but I just wanted to get your opinion on it.
Yeah, just look what you like and then figure it out from there. You know, you see the picture, so, I mean, if you like, they're all pretty easy to take care of. I mean, mm-hmm. Afghanicus are, you know, just about the same as a regular leopard gecko, you know. So, I mean, they're all going to be fairly easy if you put your time and effort into it.
Yeah. Well, thank
you
guys
decide,
for that.
Yeah, Tristan, one last thing. If you're having trouble deciding, just do what we do and just get all of them.
There you go.
Plan B. Well,
yeah
guys,
exactly.
Thank you for answering my question, and yeah.
Sure.
All right, have a good night, bud.
Yep, you too.
All right. Yeah, and I mean, you know, I'm undecided with how many I like all the morphs, so, you know, I gotta have a little bit of everything. So
yeah,
that's my problem.
I trust me, I am on list to buy everything that I don't have, so I'm the same way.
Oh man, funny. I think there will be support groups for people like us in the future. Reptile addicts and stuff. Unbelievable. John, when you know these geckos, like we've talked about, have been difficult to acquire, and they basically make their way into Europe first, and then eventually they get to us. What is, you know, it's been quite a challenge acquiring them, finding the right people to get them from, the contacts, this and that. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges that you faced, if you want to, about acquiring some animals and what it's like having animals shipped from overseas?
Well, you know, a lot of people are scared of the unknown, and it is scary to get them from overseas because you know, you have a lot of money tied up, and you got to kind of take a risk and, you know, spend money where, you know, you think you could lose it. Because honestly, like, any time I purchase anything overseas, I could never see that money again, you know. It takes you know, some daring to send over thousands of dollars to a bank account that you know, never know if you'll see it again. There's no protection from PayPal or anything on it, so
mm-hmm.
That's always scary. But I mean, you know, you got to do your research, and it comes down to that: doing a lot of homework on it, and talking to the right people, and, you know, knowing who has what. And I mean, there's a lot of people in Europe that are selling a lot of these animals that I won't touch. But, you know, if I figure out, like, I know more than most of the people I'm talking to over there about it, and I have to ask the right questions, and if they won't answer them, then I'm going to move on. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot to it, but, you know, it's one of those things. I strive to get the best stuff possible, you know, because I do it for one, for fun, for me first, or for my, you know, hobby and my animals first, and then, you know, also I want to be selling something that I can stand by, and, you know, if I sell it to somebody and it isn't what it is, then I'd feel bad about that, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah, it's difficult, you know. I've had, I've had animals confiscated on the shipment overseas from overseas over here, and you know, it's a bummer. It really eats you up. But you know, if all the paperwork isn't perfect and everything isn't perfect, you can lose animals very easily. So
yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a scary thing. I mean, well, it seems like you made out pretty good though. You only had like one so great experience out of it, and.
I haven't done that many shipments from overseas, but you know, yeah, it does. It always worries you. I couldn't sleep the whole week I was getting fusu. So, I mean, it was stressful. So, but
oh man, I can imagine. Yeah, wow. Well, it's one of the other. We're coming almost to the end of the show, but one of the things I do want to touch on compared to our common leopard gecko morphs, our Euglepharis, macularis, macularis stuff. Mm-hmm. Is there any like drastic differences in the care requirements with the subspecies and the species that we've talked about tonight compared to our common leopard geckos?
For the most part, it doesn't seem so, except for some of the Indian species. So if you're talking about Angrimonyu and, you know, Pakistan species and Turkmenistan, all those species are going to be similar as far as care goes. They do prefer, like Angrimonyu, like I couldn't get the babies to start on mealworms at all. So I don't know if that's, you know, you probably can. I feed the adults some superworms here and there, but for the most part, they're all on Dubia roaches, so... you know, I fed the baby Angrimonyu from the beginning on Dubia. So I think crickets, you know, I know the guys in Europe do crickets mostly, but I think you're going to probably find that the feeders are not as, you know, you're not going to be able to use the worms as much. Other than that, their care requirements are going to be pretty similar. The Hardwicki are going to be more of a tropical species, so you're going to have to keep them a little bit more moist. Almost similar to a fat tail. They need just a little bit more humidity to them. And same thing there. I mean, I keep mine very naturalistic. I keep them, you know, basically like dart frog substrate and like false bottoms and, you know, terrarium-style setups, you know, with heat and heat ramps and everything. So their care requirements are a little bit different. But for the most part, most of them are going to be about the same. Turkmenicus seems to like a little bit more humidity too, for the most part. You know, I find they are the first species that have shedding problems if I'm going through my racks. So I make sure I miss the Turkmenicus twice a week now, at least, based on my setup. But depending on your setup, this is another thing too. With the husbandry, it just depends on how you set them up. I set up things where I don't have to take care of them every day. But if you have in an open-air environment and really, you know, depending on where your location is, you can live in Florida and they could be probably fine without even misting half the time. And then if you live where I live or you live somewhere very dry, you're going to have to be constantly misting them. So, I mean, they're all easy as far as, you know, geckos go. And most reptiles go. If you just put a little time into it, it's pretty simple to take care of.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. All right. Well, we're coming to the end here, John, and I'd like to give you some time to basically talk about anything that you'd like as far as promotions, and if you'd like to leave us with any closing remarks, now's your chance to do that for us. And, of course, we did an excellent interview tonight. I'm just really happy with all the information.
Well, I don't have too much to say anymore, but, you know, just thanks to everybody that's been purchasing geckos. I'm trying to ship out this week. We're finally getting some warmer weather, so anybody that's been waiting for a long time to get geckos, I apologize, but, you know, Mother Nature hasn't been very cooperative lately, so hoping to get most of those out this week. It's going to be very stressful shipping this many, but, you know, glad to make some room and, you know, make some people happy at the same time. So, thanks to everybody. And, you know, if you're interested in some subspecies, you know, I have Turkmenicus and Montanus available right now. And I think I have some Afghan females still. And I should have some Angrimonyu. I had a waiting list for Angrimonyu, so I had a few people that are, you know, holding on those, but I'll have some more soon. You know, there are going to be a couple available spots for those this year.
Hardwicky, I'll have some more, you know, this next year. I got at least, I think I got 8 or 9 females breeding this year, so I'll have quite a few of those, and maybe even sell some fleece goose, so we'll see.
Nice. That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. I wish you the best of luck with these, John, and I think you're one of the best people out there that could be a steward to these very special wild type of leopard geckos. I think it takes a very dedicated and knowledgeable person to just be a caretaker, so to speak, of them, and be able to bring them, proliferate them for us over the next few years, which is going to be an important project for you. So I wish you the best of luck with them, honestly.
Great, thank you. I'm very excited about it too. Thank you.
Cool. All right, John. Thanks for coming on tonight, and we'll have you back again in the future. And thank you very much for being a sponsor of Gecko Nation Radio. It means a lot.
Sure. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Take care. Have a good night, bud.
You too.
All right, everybody. Excellent, excellent interview. As you can see, John knows his stuff. Every time I talk with John, whether it's on the air or off the air, he just impresses me somehow. His way of thinking is, I don't know. I just think he's very, very smart, very calculating. He knows what he's doing, and he does his research. And tonight, this episode, I think was one of our best interviews overall. And the information on subspecies is important because in the future, over the next few years, these geckos are going to become very popular in the trade and in the community. And over time, like anything else, we were talking a little bit about how we have the different locales and some look different than others. We're going to start seeing some different things popping out, I'm sure. Once these genes and people start selectively breeding certain ones, I think interesting things will start occurring. So, again, these are more things in the leopard gecko community and the gecko community in general to look forward to. And I also want to take this time to thank everyone in the chat room tonight. Let's see who's still with us. We have Airway Geckos, Allie from Canada, Austin West, Brooke, Brian Barrazzo, CX Gecko, a couple guests. We have Jeff Scott. We have Mike Rickett. We have MS2 Enterprises. We have Sean at Heavy Duty Reptiles. And we have Yvonne Hancock and Vogelfang, whoever that is. So I just want to thank everybody that joined us in the chat room as well. I'm going to go ahead and play the outro, and I will come back with my closing remarks.
Gecko Nation Radio is a David Fine Gecko's creation and production. You can visit the show's Facebook page at Gecko Nation Radio. I also have a great family-friendly group on Facebook called Gecko Nation. Apply for membership today. The jazz music you heard tonight was generously donated and created by Jeremy Turgeon of J&D Reptiles. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for the great musical pieces. You can check out Jeremy at J&D Reptiles on YouTube and on Facebook. And a very special thank you to our news anchor, graphic designer, and audio tech, Steve Barker. All the graphics, audio sponsor plugs, and music overlays were assembled by Steve. Check out Steve on YouTube at BC Barker Creations. He has some terrific videos for the herp community with amazing geckos and snakes.
Please support the U.S. Herpeticultural Alliance and USARC. Gecko Nation Radio is proud to support both of these organizations. Please donate to USARC so that they have the funds needed to legally protect pet owners' rights nationwide. You can donate to the USARC Legal Defense Fund at www.usarc.org. If you would also like to learn about advocacy and how you can take action on a state and local level, please subscribe to the U.S. Herpetocultural Alliance newsletter and blog at www.usherp.org.
Okay, everybody, we are back, and tonight we talked about wild types of leopard geckos, as you all know, of course. I'd like to take this time to dedicate this episode to the people in that region of the world, our soldiers that are over there, and everybody else, anybody that's suffering in that region for whatever reason. I'd like to dedicate this show to that whole area and hope that someday the Middle East is a place where not only we can go in and do studies on these amazing animals, but it's just a safe place to live and be for everybody. So those are pretty much my closing remarks. And thank you, everybody in Gecko Nation. We have a special show on Tuesday with Jonathan Fultz of Breeder Circle. And we're going to talk about ball pythons. We're going to talk about the ball python market. We're going to talk about just, you know, some of the things that are going on in the ball python world today. It's a special insider kind of look into that whole part of herpetoculture, okay? So it's going to be Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, so I hope you guys can make it. And I'm going to play a cool song for the way out. And tomorrow in the group, I will do the raffle for the people that called in, and we have Daryl, Elsa, Jeff, Carla, Marcy, and Tristan. So I hope to see you guys in the group tomorrow afternoon. And hope Marcy from MS2 gets better. Everybody out in Gecko Nation, send Marcy some positive energy so she heals well, so she can keep pumping out that roach show for everybody. All right, everybody, have a good night, and check out this song.
The chemicals.